are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Katie Gilbert on the socialist experiment in Mississippi. Meanwhile, Republicans dropped their hot mess of a tax deal. Donna Brazile reveals details of a Clinton DNC deal. Trump in the White House, apoplectic in the wake of the Manafort indictments, and the DOJ prepares to charge Russian hackers in the DNC hacking case. Meanwhile, coal miners in southern Pennsylvania reject retraining, waiting for MAGA. The EPA chief bans EPA-funded scientists from the EPA advisory boards. That's the classic, wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would let me in move, slash, just want to make sure science doesn't interfere with corporations raping the environment.
About maintaining independence.
FCC lowers the boom on local TV and opens the door for big conglomerates. Trump wall or would-be builders fear discrimination amongst normal people. And the Democrats' marginally better deal platform just got marginally better. And lastly, Robert Mercer quits his company and sells his stake in Breitbart. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot of news to get to. This story that Donna Brazile has written. I'll give you the too long don't read version, because we won't get to this until the fun half of the program. You'll recall that I think it was over the summer, probably in the spring of last year, the story came out that Hillary Clinton's campaign apparatus, fundraising apparatus, had a relationship with the states that was denying, it was the Victory Fund, which was the joint fundraising committee comprised of Clinton's presidential campaign, the DNC, and 32 state party committees. It allowed Clinton to solicit checks of more than $350,000 from high-end donors. And then it transferred that money, $3.8 million, to the states. But then that money was then resent to the DNC by and ended up in a fund essentially run by a Clinton campaign staffer. And the whole deal had to do with recent changes to campaign finance where there were no limitations on where you could spread money around. Or there was no cap on donors in their total giving. And so what they would do is they would give ostensibly to the states, and it functioned like, you know, you hear those stories of a certain country where, let's say, foreigners can't invest into, right? Americans can't invest in country X. And so you get someone in country X to be essentially your proxy. And it's your investment, but they're your proxy. It's their name on the title. That deal was something like that, and we spoke about that over the summer. But Donna Brazile has written a piece basically saying, I came in and I found this deal that outlined this. And really, the big part about this story was that it gave so much authority to the Clinton campaign in terms of how that money was directed and DNC resources were used. Obviously, this is at the beginning of the campaign back in 2015. They made this deal. Bernie Sanders was aware of this deal. He spoke out against it, I guess, in 2016, once he realized that he had a chance to win the election. But nevertheless, interesting development, not just for what it tells us, because some of that of which we knew, but that Donna Brazile is the one who's telling us.
Donna Brazile is deep cover. That's why she needed to give my wife the questions in advance of CNN to throw
double
her
agent
off the trail.
Double agent.
Now I can only hope that my wife doesn't get her hands on her.
Triple agent,
maybe
right.
Through you, Sam.
She's going to get Vince Fostered.
She's going to get Vince Fostered times Seth Rich. And here on Mini MSNBC, you're going to run interference. You're going to deny that the whole thing was rigged, even though now you have the proof. I would say listen to Lee Camp. The other honest reporters like Tim Black.
Part of the problem.
By the
way,
that was pretty embarrassing for you, wasn't it?
Yes.
When he called in the show.
Yes.
You got slammed.
Yes, that happened months ago.
Wrecked.
You're very late on this. It's just breaking now. Sam Clovis has withdrawn from consideration for the Agriculture Department post that he had to admit yesterday was completely unqualified for, which makes it really hard to justify why you're up for a post when you have absolutely no scientific background.
Hey, Sam, when was the last time you covered the Department of Agriculture? Just out of curiosity.
Just now.
Yeah, before that. When was the time, right? What was the last time you covered it?
Probably, I don't know, when Clovis was first nominated.
So just coincidentally, as soon as Donna Brazile has blown the lid off of this whole thing, and you want to minimize it because you're a goddamn Chris Hayes lesbian-looking shill, so, you go right over to Sam Clovis. You ought to be disgusted with yourself. I think after what Tim Black did to you, you might have taken a moment to reflect on being a sellout careerist who hasn't done anything worthwhile since a goddamn cameo in Sex and the City.
I knew you
but
were
now
say
you're
that.
Still.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, well, sometimes you're just beats you got to hit, Sam. You wouldn't know that, though, as a failed comedian.
Apparently, someone spent the night on YouTube. But we will talk more about this as we go. But it's a good development. And apparently, the part of the story is that the DNC was completely deprived of funds, in part because Barack Obama left Debbie Wasserman Schultz there, whom apparently everyone thought was completely incompetent. And he was happy to have a total incompetent there because he didn't want the competition in terms of any power base outside the White House. But
check
that's
the couch
it.
Change, Jill girl. Oh! What? World star, baby.
All right. So before we get to this interview with Katie Gilbert on Chakwe Antar Lumumba and what's going on in Jackson, still fallout, obviously, from the terror attack on Tuesday. And, you know, we didn't get into a deep discussion with it here. I spoke with Digby about it for Ring of Fire, and I imagine we'll talk about it with Cliff. But, you know, the bottom line is the distinction between this attack on Monday, or I should say on Tuesday in New York City, where a man drove a truck down the West Side Highway bike lane to kill people and did. When you compare and contrast that with the man in Las Vegas who fired a automatic weapon on a crowd of 20,000 people, killing almost three times as many people, injuring almost 50 times more people. When you start asking why did they do this, the reason why you ask these questions is how can we prevent this in the future? How can we mitigate? And to the extent that we can't prevent it in the future, how can we mitigate the damage that can take place? in Las Vegas. The obvious way of mitigating what happens there is perhaps, I guess, to increase security. I don't know how you would prevent people from bringing guns in, frankly, in their luggage. But you could prevent access to guns. Now, we don't do that in this country because of statutes and because of interpretations of the Constitution and because of massive amounts of money that are poured into our political system. When you contemplate what could be done in the case of New York, you could put more sophisticated curbing, which is there in New York in many places. And you could maybe make it harder for someone to do that with a truck, or at least give them maybe a little more heads up that, hey, something's going weird. Why is that truck weaving through these different pylons to get onto this thing? Whatever it is. But because there was no direct connection to ISIS, because there was nothing operational, because the guy didn't travel to Syria to get training, because he was just a guy living here, came in as an immigrant 8 years ago, I suppose you could say we're not going to allow any immigrants in, but as Ronald Reagan pointed out on Twitter yesterday, that if you read this book about the terror plot that was stopped in the 90s, it was stopped by a guy who came in the exact same visa from Egypt. So, you know, you're not necessarily going to get less. In fact, there's a good argument that you could get more of this if you, because for every one immigrant you let in who is ultimately going to do something like this, you are probably letting in hundreds, if not thousands, who would be in the best position to stop someone from doing like something like this. So the idea that there's a broader lesson here is only a narrative that's going to be pushed by people. There's no practical application for making an issue of this guy's religion or the fact that he followed ISIS on YouTube. Any more than there was when, like, hey, rock and roll music is driving people to commit suicide. Unless there's some type of operational ties, there's just no value in it unless you have another agenda. Like, let's say this guy, Brian Kilmeade, whose agenda might be, hey, we need another block of programming. Oh, how about our anti-Muslim block?
See something, say something. If I see an angry Muslim who goes into a supermarket, always arguing with the cashiers, is that enough for me to go up to an officer and say I'm saying something without being labeled anti-Islamic?
If you just see someone who's angry and from a religious community, that is not enough.
That is not enough. So at least they were good enough to bring on someone who would say, that's not enough. I think the proper response is, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, that's Waleed Faris, who is not a great guy.
And if he becomes the voice of reason, yeah. Right? Like, what, where
that is
that?
First step to jihad, you complain at grocer. Number one.
In, you start yelling, why don't you have halal hot dogs in your 7-Eleven?
I think you have overcharged for many soft drinks. And Baghdadi has released new fatwa. I'm going to blow the whole fucking thing up.
Is this gum fresh? I am a Muslim and must
this
know.
This is not cinnamon. I am a Muslim, sir. This grocer is not Sharia compliant.
I wonder if he's got is he going through something at his local bodega?
Kilmeade's having an anxiety attack because there's something. He's like, I think he's a Muslim.
He seems mad. And I think he's Muslim.
It's probably like a Dominican guy speaking in Spanish to his friend.
Right, exactly. I wonder how polite and nice Kilmeade is as a customer in some of these places.
Oh, fuck you, Sam. It's a serious question. It's a Muslim being rude. Go listen to some Fleetwood Mac and kill yourself.
I bet something like 70% of the vendors who deal with Kilmeade on any type of regular basis are like, oh, this fucking asshole again.
Or like, what the hell is the matter with that guy? Oh. He still doesn't know how the Slurpee machine works.
All right. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to journalist Katie Gilbert on the socialist experiment that is taking place in the form, possibly, of Chakwe Lumumba. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I'd like to welcome to the program Katie Gilbert. She's a freelance writer who is writing for OxfordAmerican.org. The piece is The Socialist Experiment. Welcome to the program, Katie.
Thank you very much.
So, all right, Katie, let's just start with this. Before we go into the story of Chokwe Lumumba and Antar Lumumba, and frankly, Jackson, Mississippi, I'm curious, why did you write this piece?
Sure. Well, as I touched on pretty briefly in the piece, I've spent several years as a regular contributor for a financial trade magazine called Institutional Investor. And the beat I'd kind of assumed for 5 years or so was socially responsible investing. So this idea that there are investment products that are more focused on being kinder to the environment or human rights or what have you, and that this can help make our economy fairer. It interested me for a while, but I started to feel I was getting a lot more interested in grassroots versions, trying to achieve those same goals rather than some of these products that are being thought of on Wall Street. So I started looking around for what I was thinking of as economic experiments around the United States, and especially those that were gaining traction since the recession. And I found a few. I visited a commune in Virginia that's not new. It's been around 50 years, and a few other things. But when I came upon what was happening in Jackson, Mississippi, I was very interested. The first thing I learned about happening there was this effort around developing a network of worker cooperatives that would create good jobs for people in the city where there's a big problem with longstanding poverty there. Businesses that would meet human needs and also not move if they weren't turning enough of a profit, which the city's had a problem with.
All right. Well, hold on. Before we get into what is actually was in Jackson, Mississippi, give us a sense of Jackson, Mississippi as a place to sort of, I guess, let us know the context in which these experiments are taking place.
Right. Yeah, that is important. Jackson, Mississippi is obviously the capital of the state. It's had an interesting history in the past few decades, and it's changed a lot. So it was a majority white city as recently, I believe, as the early 70s, mid-70s. And as things started to change in Jackson, similar to a lot of southern cities, as schools were desegregated and the kind of white segregationist power structure started to crumble, it experienced a lot of white flight. So it's now an 85% black city. The city was shrinking pretty quickly in the 90s, and it's leveled off a bit. It shrunk a little bit more slowly in the first decade of 2000s, but it's struggling with a declining tax base. It's having a hard time making payments on things as basic as keeping up its infrastructure. So as soon as you go to Jackson, Mississippi, one of the first things you'll hear anyone talking about are all the potholes that just aren't being addressed. The water distribution system is facing problems, and there was a scare with lead last year, as I recall. So it's facing some pretty fundamental problems in meeting some of its basic needs as a city. And even in the downtown, there are a lot of storefronts that are empty. But obviously there are a lot of really great and interesting things happening there too, which I think we'll get into in terms of seeing some of these problems as an opening to rethink how economic solutions might be proposed.
And we should say Jackson is the biggest city in Mississippi by far, right? I mean, there's like 170,000 some odd people there, and I think the next closest city is probably like closer to 65,000. So this is the biggest city in the state. And so when, tell us about the history of, I mean, this isn't the existence of a socialist experiment in these co-ops is not particularly new per se. Give us a sense of like what the a brief recounting and your piece is very comprehensive on this, but give us a brief recounting of sort of the history leading up to, let's say, the last 10 years or so.
Right. And there are so many pieces to it, so I admit I do sometimes have a hard time being brief, especially when writing about it. But basically, I think a good place to start in looking at the history and understanding what's happening in Jackson right now is the late 60s, when a group formed in Detroit called the Provisional Government, the Republic of New Africa. And what this group was seeking to do was create a new nation and a new society within it. That would be based in socialist principles. It would be majority black and led by black people, and it would occupy five southern states, which this group thought that it would be able to peacefully petition the U.S. government for as a sort of reparations. And the idea was that if you could have a separate nation, you could appeal to international bodies with human rights issues, and the people who formed this group had determined that the United States government had shown that they didn't have any interest in doing that when it came to some of the violence and atrocities that black people were facing in this country. So there was not a lot of headway made petitioning the government, not surprisingly. And there was a day in the early 70s when a few members of this group went down to Mississippi because they had bought land from a farmer there and decided that if they couldn't have all five of these states, they would at least take control of some land and build a dining hall, a few things, and where black people could go and start to democratically create together a new society where everyone would have what they need and be treated with fairness.
A commune.
Right. Yeah. I didn't see them use that word necessarily, but it's what it sounded like to me. Chokwe Lumumba was in law school at the time, and he was one of the people who went there in the early 70s, what they called Land Celebration Day, to move on to this land and start to build something there. And it was only a few months before the farmer who sold them that land reneged on the oral agreement. They didn't have the land anymore. And long story short, over the next few years, didn't make a lot of headway in attracting people to the cause, faced a lot of pressure from COINTELPRO and other issues they faced from law enforcement. But people like Chokwe Lumumba still had this vision, this idea of creating a new society where they felt that there would not be racial inequity, class inequity, and the rest of it. So he formed a couple of groups, and in the 90s, one of them was the Malcolm X grassroots movement that had a different tack, really, but wanted to focus on this idea of creating new political systems, economic systems that were fairer. The idea at that point for MXGM, the Malcolm X grassroots movement, wasn't necessarily, you know, sovereignty anymore, but this kind of different organizing tactic. And that group in the early 2000s started to write a document called the Jackson-Kush Plan that laid out three main pillars in trying to push this really ambitious goal of societal change, the United States, staging the experiment in Jackson, Mississippi, but letting that experiment be a model to the rest of the country and the world, especially cities facing similar problems.
Let me ask you this. Why? I mean, was it just by chance that it was Jackson, Mississippi, or was there a sense that there was the proper or perfect context to like both a need and the resources? And I mean, was there something about Jackson that became there was a sense amongst the MXGM and Lumumba that Jackson was the place to do this, as opposed to, I don't know, Detroit?
Yeah, it's a great question. There was a really determined, concerted decision made that Jackson was the place to do this. And that was even voted on by MXGM members at the national level. And as it's been explained to me, the reasons that Jackson was seen as the perfect place to, again, kind of be the staging ground for this ambitious experiment was that, one, it's majority Black. Two, it's within a region of the United States, it's majority Black. The way that the Jackson-Kush plan gets the name Kush is from what's referred to by this group as the Kush District, 18 contiguous counties in the western part of Mississippi that are either majority Black, or there's one that's 47% Black. So there's this idea that Black people in that region will be likely to accept these ideas and bring them into their own communities as well, and to spread them. And Mississippi itself is about 40% Black, with the highest concentration of Black people in the country. So, and in addition to that, Jackson, it was seen as an asset kind of to this group that there's not a lot of industrial power, economic engines there right now. It leaves this void that needs to be filled with some reimagining.
So the I don't want to say the depression, but the lack of genuine economic engines was seen as a positive, because there's going to be less entrenched interests that would resist or be more resistant to some type of change.
That's right. Yeah, that's how I've heard it explained.
And exactly. And what can you tell us about the way the relationship between the idea that there was such a high concentration of Black folk and the sense that also would contribute to, I guess, the buy-in to a different economic system or organizational structure in that area?
Yeah, it's a good question, and that's something that I've wondered about too. I think, as I heard Rukia Lumumba explain it this way, and her sister, who also ran his campaign, that this vision was never, or is certainly not now, exclusively for Black people, but Black people historically in this country, as well as other groups like Indigenous people, have borne the brunt of the system that we have built up here, that has been built up here, and have been excluded from a lot of the economic gains that our system has wrought. And so the idea, at least among this group, it's not necessarily totally clear whether this plays out, but the idea is that leaves Black people and, frankly, disenfranchised people more broadly, more likely to have an open mind when it comes to radical reimaginings of the dominant dominant economic system.
So the so on one level, the I guess the sort of cultural, or I guess specifically the racial homogeny in that instance is one less barrier to accepting something that is radically different. I mean, there's also, I think, you know, in this country, a very strong tradition. I don't know if it was a couple of months ago, we spoke to Robin Kelly about his work on the African-American communists in the 30s, primarily trying to organize in Alabama. But there's certainly like a longstanding tradition. But it's interesting that the different sort of, I guess, contexts that these folks wanted to, that they saw as advantageous to them. And I guess in terms of building solidarity, there was also, at the very least, certainly the first go round, a lot of solidarity imposed upon them by the KKK in some respects.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I'm sure exactly as a similar idea here, although the fact was that when the PGRNA, that provisional government of the Republic of New Africa, came to Jackson in the 70s, hoping to kind of have a lot of people there, black people specifically, flock to the cause, it didn't really happen. And I think the expectation was that there was that kind of solidarity that would come from fear and oppression and some of the forces there, but people in Jackson at the time, including black people, saw this idea as kind of coming from somewhere outside, not necessarily a homegrown idea. The people who were leading it weren't people they knew, and so that made it hard for the PGRNA at the time. And like I said, they were facing lots of other challenges too, but I think Cooperation Jackson, the group today that's building cooperatives and operating on the Jackson-Cush plan of this new society vision, is coming up against challenges too in a similar way, that it's not necessarily the case that everybody who's struggling economically wants a similar type of solution or
right.
has similar ideas about, you know, what a good radical path forward would be.
All right. Well, so let's go. Let's talk about Jacques Lumumba, his how he gets into politics. I mean, at one point in your piece, when you're talking about his son, and I guess I may have neglected to mention that his son obviously is now the sitting mayor of Jackson as of, I guess, I don't know, 5 or 6 months ago. But the question that you raise in the piece is, can you be a politician and a revolutionary simultaneously? Tell us about how Chakwe Lumumba came to run and win the race for mayor in Jackson, and what was his agenda?
Well, when Chakwe Lumumba first ran for office, it was in 2009, I believe, for city council. And he hadn't long entertained visions of himself as a politician. He was a lawyer. He was a noted lawyer for defending black nationalists and had been for a while. But around that time, the Jackson-Cush plan was kind of being finalized, and one of its pillars is nurturing this network of progressive local politicians who support the Jackson-Cush plan. So one of the authors of the Jackson-Cush plan approached Chakwe Lumumba and asked if he'd consider running for mayor. And at the time, Lumumba decided, no, he and the organization weren't quite ready for that. What if he ran for city council? And some of the other folks in MXGM approached his son, then I think about 25, Chakwe and Carl Lumumba, and asked him to consider running for city council or considering a run for mayor later on. At the time, Ansar said, no, you know, I've just gotten back to Jackson after law school. I'm about to get married. I just don't see myself as a politician anyway. And he even talked to his father and asked if, you know, should his father really be doing this? But ultimately, it was decided that Lumumba would run, and he won the council race, obviously. He went on to run for mayor in 2013. And he wasn't necessarily a strong kind of front runner in the race the whole time. He won the he finished in second place in the Democratic primary, and in Jackson, the Democratic primary is really what decides the winner. So since nobody had won a majority, it went to a runoff election, and he had kind of a very decisive debate, and a lot of people see that as kind of what tipped the race in his favor, and he ended up winning the mayoral election by a pretty slim margin. And I think at the time there was a lot of excitement among people who knew about the Jackson-Cush plan and supported it, but there was, not surprisingly, some apprehension from people who knew Lumumba as this former black nationalist and wanted to see him however they wanted to see him. But he was in office for 8 months and was pretty widely regarded from just about everyone I talked to in Jackson as someone who helped bring the city together, was willing to work across the aisle, and was starting to make headway in Jackson, but died suddenly, unfortunately, 8 months after he took office.
Had he begun to institute anything that people perceived as radical? Was there, I mean, because there's, there was one politician, I guess, who was from the State House, who had said to him at one point, according to your piece, like, I was a little bit worried about you because you were sold to me as someone who was divisive, but you're not that way at all. Was that an assessment of Lumumba's policies, or was it an assessment of his approach?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good distinction. I think that given how briefly he was in office, it was more of an assessment of his approach. But that said, I mean, his main policy achievement while in office was instituting this 1% sales tax that something like 90% of the city of Jackson voted on. And that was going to be creating this fund to help pay for some much needed infrastructure fixes in the city. And a lot of people in Jackson saw that as a big achievement because the administration had managed to get so many people to come over to this pretty unpopular decision to tax themselves, but that he had sold it well. But then again, that's not a radical policy, and there are some people within his administration who didn't see that as the political direction they wanted the administration to go. And this kind of gets back to your question about, can you be both a revolutionary and a politician? You know, someone who kind of makes the trains run on time and has to sell a tax increase to people while also envisioning major systemic change. I mean,
right.
That would have happened.
You got to do the potholes. Yeah. You got to literally fill the potholes as mayor. And so there was really no sense as to that experiment was too nascent in some ways.
I think so.
All right. So let's talk about his son, because, I mean, it's interesting and it's hard to sort of interpret. His son runs for who had really, according to your piece, no design ever to be an elected politician. And literally at the deathbed of his father makes the decision to run. And to fill his position as mayor, he loses his first election in 2014, and he runs again in 2017. Let's pick it up there. What ticket does he run, and what is his platform?
Well, he did run as a Democrat, and in a pretty crowded field. There were, by primary day, 9 other Democrats on the ticket. His platform, I mean, he talked a lot about having this people's platform. When I become mayor, you become mayor. And democratizing as many kind of city decision-making processes as possible. So one way his father did that was through people's assemblies where different neighborhoods would gather together, and the mayor would be there, members of his administration, to listen to problems in different neighborhoods and kind of help decide on what solutions would be. So that's a part of the platform. He talked a lot, Shokwe Antar talked a lot in the debates I went to and in the interviews I listened to about worker cooperatives. And he stresses that the idea is not to turn the whole economy into, you know, a network of worker cooperatives, but that there needs to be more of an effort in people in Jackson investing in their own businesses and services that they need, and not relying on outside corporations to kind of descend in and bring the jobs. But Antar also talks about the need for others to come and invest in the city. So he definitely has some moderation when he talks about some of these radical ideas that, you know, a little bit of the worker cooperatives would be good, a little bit of the investment would be good too, but we need to be involving everyone in the city in these processes and making them very transparent. And he's been in office about 100 days now. He just hit that mark a couple of days ago, I believe, and there'll be a State of the City speech in a couple of days. So I think, again, it's so early, not many specifics to kind of share yet, but it's going to continue to be really interesting to watch.
All right, so asking for an assessment on how he's doing at this point, a little bit premature. But let me just lastly ask you this. In talking to you, in your reporting and in conversations you've had with him, in terms of his perspective on what he wants to achieve, when he starts to talk about things like, you know, bringing in, you know, I guess private partnerships, I don't know if he articulated it that way, but is his perspective like, we need to do this slowly, like we need to walk people down this path slowly, or is it, is his incrementalism a tactic or a strategy, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it's during the campaign, it definitely seemed like a strategy. I mean, I think that in communicating some of these ideas that had gotten his father labeled as a radical, he saw the need to, I don't think misconstrue them, but make them more widely understood and more palatable to people. And so now that he's in office, I think it's true that kind of taking small steps towards some of the ideas that, you know, look more like socialism or whatever it may be, will be a strategic move. But again, I mean, that's speculation on my part. And I haven't had a chance to talk to anyone within the administration since Inauguration Day, so that would be a good
thing. Are you planning to do a follow-up?
Maybe so. I mean, it's definitely the case that, you know, now that he's in office, after he's in office a year or two, there'll be a whole other story to tell about this, I think, and I will definitely want to know what it is.
Well, I think we will, too. Katie Gilbert, the piece is The Socialist Experiment. It's an Oxford American. We will link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, folks, we are in the midst of our survey extravaganza, wherein we extravagantly invite you to take our survey, which will help us get a better sense of why you listen, how you listen, what you might listen to. Listen. Or watch, I guess. So regardless of how you consume the show, if you're a member, we have at Majority Report, what is it, MajoritySurvey.com? Son of a gun. I was doing so well with that pitch, and then I forgot what it was called. MajoritySurvey.com is the URL. And if you head over to MajoritySurvey.com, you will have the option of clicking on the free show. That's if you're not a member, whether we give you a deal on the membership or not. If you're not a member and you don't have access to the fun half, then you just click on the free show. If you're watching me right now on YouTube, then you click on the YouTube one. If you're a member of the show, you get the full access to the full podcast, click on the member one. And only do it once, but that's all you need to do. Do it once, and it'll take you like 6 or 7 minutes, depending on which one of these you end up taking. So really important, very helpful to us. And so thank you in advance. Of course, you can go fill out the free show survey and then say, hey, I'm going to become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you become a member. Don't forget, if you want to, if you purchase your items, want to see what we're offering via Amazon or Jet.com, head over to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click through there. Purchase your items through there. That's a helpful thing to do for yourself. Got to be very careful with the language. In a certain sense. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Right now they have that, what's that one, Brendan, which is the one that we have? It's a seasonal one, I've been told. It's the...
Brendan, what do we got?
It's the Day of the Dead one, or Waking the Dead. Oh, yeah, all right.
Nice.
Wow, I forgot.
Product placement right there.
Wake the Dead.
Show it to the camera, dude.
Nicaraguan and Guatemalan blend. This is the one. And then, of course, we also got the, not this one, the Majority Report.
Did they get started in the 80s with the Sandinistas? Is that how far back it goes?
It's possible.
Yeah.
And here, of course, is the Majority Report blend, which you can get. Show your friends. It's also great. This is a Ethiopian, Ugandan, Indonesian blend, which I personally chose. No, I mean, I didn't.
Yeah, sure.
I just said I wanted a blend. All right, folks, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. See you in the fun half. band.